From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
We filed two bills that address our pension concerns here in Illinois. We can't sit around and wait for a compilation of 15 or 16 bills to magically appear.
My concern is that that means that you're sort of acknowledging and saying that the grand bargain's dead, and we don't want to do that.
The Unbalanced Budget Response Act would authorize the governor to take actions necessary to balance the budget in 2018,
but you would be able to make cuts to all these agency budgets, and you can't tell us what those cuts would be. It's a little like handing a razor blade to a toddler right now. I mean, we have no idea what cuts it is that you would make. Doesn't it make sense to come to us with the list of cuts before asking for that power?
The list does not exist.
Well, that is Scott Harry, Governor Rauner's budget director, responding to the Democratic Senator Don Harmon of Oak Park. And before that, you heard from Senator Heather Staines, a Democrat, and Republican Senator Michael Connolly, as Governor Rauner and Senate Republicans now talking about breaking off pieces of that grand bargain into separate legislation. The idea of a grand bargain on the budget now seems a long time ago. We're going to get an update of where things stand coming up. And also, the Help Wanted sign is up at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Chicago. That and more coming up on today's show in Springfield. I'm Sean Crawford, and I'm joined in studio by Charlie Wheeler. Charlie's director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. In our Statehouse Bureau is the Illinois Public Radio Statehouse reporter Brian Mackey, and our guest today is Bernie Schoenberg, political writer and columnist with the State Journal Register in Springfield. Bernie, it's good to have you back on.
Nice to be here, Sean.
Well, let's start talking. I'll let you guys downtown tell us where things stand with the idea of a grand bargain. It took center stage again this week. Not much movement seems to be happening, though.
Yeah, well, we had a couple of Republican senators came out and said that they wanted to start pushing the pension portion of the grand bargain independently. There are two pieces of legislation that would involve this consideration model that would force employees to choose and ultimately result in a reduction in pension costs and pension benefits over the long run. It would also add some of the governor's ideas, like a tier three, a new sort of pension system that is like a 401k. And it would let also incorporate another idea that would let people buy out of the pension plan if they wanted to do so. And that's sort of one aspect of this. The other aspect is that it would send a one-time cash infusion to the Chicago Public Schools, which, if they don't get that, have threatened shortening their school year and potentially missing the pension payment that is due for them this summer. And Democrats reacted to that not very well. They basically say that this is another sign, in their view, that people are not taking the grand bargain seriously on the Republican side of the aisle, or that, you know, that they think it indicates that people might think it's dead.
Yeah, I also think the fact that the Chicago Public Schools were expecting $215 million for pensions, and then Governor Rauner vetoed the bill, saying that there had not been a statewide pension plan passed as he had been promised. That got a little statewide publicity a couple weeks ago when Chance the Rapper met with Governor Rauner. That let perhaps 3 million Twitter followers, if they were following that day, know that Illinois schools, because of a veto from the governor of Illinois, are out $215 million. I think some Democrats look at this as a way the governor could get over that problem and get a quick bill. But again, as Brian said, it takes it out of the grand bargain, which would make passage of the grand bargain even less likely than it already is.
Yeah, that's truly a house of cards, isn't it? I mean, you remove one piece and it seems like it could all come crumbling down. That's at least what the Democrats are saying here. But why couldn't they just act on the education portion? There's enough in that grand bargain and the ideas that are there that it seems like they could work on one portion of it and still have enough to negotiate otherwise.
It occurs to me that they could if there was any level of trust at all. I think the level of trust among Democrats for Governor Rauner is about the same level of trust that the U.S. government has in the government of North Korea and vice versa. Rauner and Republicans don't trust the Democrats, and Rauner spent a lot of time demonizing Democratic leadership, House Speaker Michael Madigan. And it's the kind of thing, the reason we have the grand bargain in the sense of all these bills interlocked is because neither side trusts the other one. If the bill that you like I pass, I don't think you will honor your word and pass the one I want, or in the case of the governor, sign the one I want. And that's why they're written in such a way that they either all are enacted into law or they all die. And if there were the level of trust that existed historically in Illinois up until the time Rod Blagojevich became governor, you wouldn't have to go through this stuff. It would be, yeah, Governor Ryan or Governor Edgar or Governor Thompson would say, here, I'll be for this if you'll be for that, and that would be fine. It would be a handshake, an understanding, because there was a level of trust that doesn't exist today. And so that's part of the difficulty, and that's why I think it was so important for Senate President Cullerton, Minority Leader Redonio, to sit down and put this stuff together, where they actually, personally, they worked together, they trusted each other, but they had to put in this interlocking mechanism because of the general lack of trust between the executive and the legislative branches.
And Brian, eventually we're going to have some budget at some point. It may not be this year. It may not be next year. We don't know. But eventually something will have to happen, and it may have to include all these different pieces. We all get that, I guess. But at this point, it seems as though, from where I sit, that this whole idea of this grand bargain, they say, oh, it's still alive, we're negotiating it. But boy, we seem in such a holding pattern that it doesn't seem to be making much movement at all.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know that we have to have a budget anymore, right? I mean, you'd think, and that's something that would have been even a ridiculous statement to question or to say a few years ago, but we've just been coasting along for such a long time now. I keep waiting for, which shoe to drop is going to be to go to the metaphor store and mix some more metaphors. You know, what's going to be the straw that breaks the back? And it hasn't happened yet. And I think that you say, well, these things are all going to have to become law. I don't think everybody sees it that way, right? The Democrats say, look, we don't really, our priority is not procurement and changing the workers' compensation system. And, there are Democrats who want to change the cost of pensions. But these other things, they say, we're doing that because the governor has insisted on it. The governor insists that he's not going to negotiate a balanced budget, which, even he acknowledges requires tax increases to get to a balanced budget. The governor says, I'm not going to do that unless I get these other things that will be, structural changes in state government, he calls it. And that has included everything from term limits and changing the way legislative districts are drawn to freezing property taxes at the local level. And so Democrats say, we don't want to do that stuff, but, at least in the Senate Democrats are saying it's gotten so bad now out there, and it's really, we are willing to vote for these things we don't want to vote for in order to get to this deal. And their accusation is that the governor keeps moving the goalposts on what would constitute a good deal, and they say that's why they didn't include the governor in their negotiations in this latest round.
Bernie, there seems to be a situation where we have, individual lawmakers. You talk to a lot of the rank-and-file lawmakers who, if it's up to them, they'd love to have a budget in place. Sure, they would like to have certain things become law to make it happen, but it seems as though there's a willingness to compromise among them. Is there enough pressure being put on people higher up, the Michael Madigans, the Governor Rauner?
Well, I don't see that yet. I mean, rank and file on both sides, we all know, would love to get this deal done because everywhere they go, people are asking them, please fix this. Our social service agency is struggling. The local college is getting basically no money from the state right now, and it has gotten only a fraction of what it got 2 years ago. And, and this thing goes on. But the governor, in a bold move showing he wants to run for re-election but also support the Republican Party and other candidates, just a couple months ago put $50 million of his own into his own campaign fund that is just sitting out there. So he has said repeatedly, and Brian talked about the priorities that he has, which, again, run from term limits to a property tax freeze, which he wants to be permanent, that he, is a stubborn son of a, and he always says son of a, and then he says, gun, to make people laugh. I've heard that perhaps 20 times. Anyway, And he changes hard, and it takes a long time. And he was in, I think it was Quincy this past week, and I listened to the tape of what he said to a business group there. He goes to a lot of business groups, not a lot of social service agencies, to make these talks, and because he has an audience that believes what he does, that you want the business climate to be better, and then everything will be better in the state. And he sounded pretty much just like he did 2 years ago. And on the Madigan side, you know, again, Democrats support unions and get support from unions. It's philosophical as well as financial. And they're just not going to fold and do what the governor wants. That was probably never going to happen with an overwhelmingly Democratic legislature. But the two sides still, you know, don't realize the other's not moving.
Well, to get to your question about pressure, Sean, I think that for people who believe in what the governor's doing, right, believe that labor unions have too much power, particularly government sector labor unions have too much power, who believe that Illinois has been hostile to businesses and needs to be friendlier to businesses, if you're a true believer in that, like the governor is, I think that his stubbornness and his sort of resistance to outside pressure is a feature. I mean, Republican primary voters elected a man who said, I have enough money that no one's ever going to tell me what to do. And I think that we've seen the results of that. He can be as stubborn as he wants to be, and with the seeming confidence that he has enough money to insulate himself from whatever attacks and public, you know, whatever attacks are going to come, and to shape the public perception of his term.
And Charlie, there's certainly I don't think anybody would complain and say, oh, there's too much trust going on at the Capitol. As you mentioned earlier, this lack of trust is leading to a lot of this. But stubbornness also plays a role. You've got two people, especially in the Speaker and in the Governor, are used to getting what they want.
Particularly in the case of the Governor, I think I would say that I can look back on Michael Madigan's history, and I can see numerous instances in which Madigan didn't get 100% of what he wanted. Offhand, I can't remember more than one or two times when he got zero, but typically it was he got something and whoever was on the other side of the table got something. And the atmosphere was more, we have to figure out a way that we can both walk away saying we didn't get everything, but we didn't get shut out.
Let me ask.
We're both winning. And now it seems to be the determination is, I don't win unless you also lose.
Let me ask you, Charlie, because a lot of times from what I had seen was when both sides won, it often had to do with things like projects that they could, you know, we passed this and you're going to get something in your district. We're going to make sure your constituents are, you know, happy with what you're doing here. They don't have the money to do that type of thing right now. Does that make it harder?
Well, I think it does. And I'm not sure why, but an infrastructure bill was not part of the grand bargain. Now, the people who put the grand bargain together said, well, that's just too complicated. But it occurs to me, again, going on past history, having projects out there makes it easier for lawmakers to take hard votes. To put it a very simplistic way, I can go home and tell my constituents, yeah, you're going to have to pay more for X, but on the other hand, that road is going to get fixed. The high school gym's not going to leak anymore, that kind of stuff. There's some tangible result. Although sometimes it's based on policy, too. I mean, when Jim Egger was first elected, he wanted a statewide property tax freeze. Democrats didn't want anything. They controlled both houses. The compromise was, okay, we'll freeze property taxes in the collar counties. And that enabled them to reach an agreement on other stuff in Edgar's first year, and they were able to move forward.
Well, of course, we've talked a lot about people who are waiting on money from the states, and you can add state lawmakers to that. Brian and Bernie, there has been some court action regarding the paychecks for state lawmakers. Where does that all stand?
Yeah, just to refresh people's recollections, the state legislators, a few years ago, Governor Quinn vetoed state lawmaker pay to say in order to try and get them to pass his preferred pension change plan. And House Speaker Madigan and Senate President Cullerton went to court to say that is unconstitutional. You're usurping the balance of powers. And the courts agreed with that and reinstated the pay. And after that, to prevent that from happening again, legislators made their paycheck a continuing appropriation. That means even if there's no budget passed, that money gets sent out every year. The same thing happens with pension funding, debt service for our bond payments. There are a number of things that just kind of go out automatically in state government. So fast forward to last year, the budget impasse had been going on for, about 10 months at that point. And the then controller, Leslie Munger, decided, I'm going to make lawmakers wait just as long as every other vendor, months and months and months, to get their payments from the state. And I think since that time, lawmakers have seen maybe two or three paychecks.
I know they come late.
Very, like months and months yeah. late. And, you know, there are plenty of lawmakers who are lawyers or retirees who this is not necessarily their primary form of income, but there are other ones who have kids in college. We've heard of one who is driving an Uber car up in Chicago just to get some extra money. And so a group of current and lame duck legislators last fall decided to sue to try and get their payments expedited. And a judge issued at least a preliminary ruling this week saying that, no, you have to wait in line just like everyone else because you have the power. I'm reminded of the Wizard of Oz. You have the power to end this budget impasse. All you have to do is pass a budget, and then you can get paid on time.
Yeah, but the judge did say he would wait to make a decision and file more briefs.
So apparently he's going to let he made that decision, left the courtroom, and came back in and said, well, I'm going to let you guys file some more briefs, and then I'll rule, there's another hearing set for next week now. At least based on that preliminary ruling, things not looking very good.
Well, what's interesting about this is Susana Mendoza, the Democrat who ended up beating Leslie Munger for comptroller, ran on the no budget, no pay platform herself because it's so popular that, you know, a legislator shouldn't get paid unless they pass a budget. So it's just politically popular to do that. The other interesting aspect of this, I think, is the governor now has expanded this beyond, Brian talked about the constitutional balance between the legislature and the governor. The governor wants all state employees to continue to get paid under court orders, saying that they should be just like legislators. And, of course, he stresses legislators only work part-time, which, of course, some of them work harder than others, but some of them are busy all the time with meetings and things. And some of them use it as a full-time job. The governor says state employees should be on continuing appropriation and is pushing a bill by Avery Bourne, a state representative from south of Springfield, to get that done. On the other hand, that would, there is the argument that would, what about, and as Brian asked the governor repeatedly, well, what about social service agencies that are supposed to get paid on contract by the state? Don't they work all the time? And the governor said, well, state employees are different. They're doing their jobs. But it has been argued, and I know Rich Miller of Capital Facts has argued more than once, that would give a tremendous amount of authority to the executive branch to do whatever it wants, including hiring thousands of employees and paying thousands of employees as everybody else languishes in the state. So I'm not sure if a judge will go for that, but we'll see.
And I would just briefly add, I've said this before, and I've done stories on this in the past, that the political science research shows that states that have better paying legislators, have a more professional legislature. And if you have lower paying legislatures, you tend to get very rich people. So if you want a legislature that more sort of reflects the diversity, economic diversity of a state, you want people to be able to afford to do this job where they have to be in Springfield for, days and days and days, months and months out of the year, then, you have to pay them a little more.
And it's worked in Illinois, right? So.
Yeah, well, fair. Touche.
We have problems. But the whole idea of, the legislature or the Constitution says you can't diminish pay of a public official or change it during their term. And the reason for that is so that people can't use their pay as pressure to do a specific thing, like Pat Quinn found out.
I would just add, the governor did make $180-something million last year.
It's about $2 million, or $1 million every couple of days at least, yeah.
Yeah, so he is not affected.
But he often stresses that he is working for free. He always says he's working for free. He's doing this as a public service, not taking his salary.
And before we move on to a different topic, Charlie, I'll let you get a word in on this one, too.
Well, it occurs to me that, as was said already, if you step back from the personalities involved now, there's a very sound reason why you want to insulate the paycheck from one branch of government from retribution in the other. By the same token, the legislature could not decide, okay, we're not going to pay the Secretary of State on the same principle that you don't want the actions of one branch to be coerced by the economic pressure that another branch can bring on them. And so that's what the court ruled in the case of Quinn vetoing the legislators' salaries. And that's what would happen if the General Assembly decided, okay, we're not going to pay salaries for any of the statewide elected officials until they do X, Y, Z. It's sort of a fundamental premise in our form of government that you have the separation of powers. By the same token, the stuff that is included in Representative Burns' continuing appropriation bill for state employees, in my mind, goes beyond what the executive branch is entitled to do. It would take the decisions about spending money, and the same with the bill that we talked about at the introduction, that allows the governor to make cuts wherever he wants, although his agency heads refuse to identify any of them. That takes the power of the purse away from the General Assembly where it belongs and makes the governor kind of a quasi-dictator. And he's got another legal theory out there that's saying, well, because the law requires the Department of X to do this, therefore it's kind of a continuing appropriation because they have this responsibility, so we should pay them without a budget. I mean, it's just, in a sense, again, divorced from the personalities, it's a real effort by the executive to seize power away from the legislature, and I don't think that's a good idea.
Bernie, let me turn to you because the Trump administration has forced out many U.S. attorneys across the country, including the federal prosecutor right there in Chicago, Zachary Farden, his name getting a lot of headlines, including the prosecution successfully of the former Illinois House or former U.S. House Speaker Dennis Hastert that took place last year. What's happening with that? What's the process for replacing him and why is it creating some headlines?
Well, first of all, it's not unusual for other presidents have asked for resignations that they always haven't been as quick as this one happened, but for resignations of U.S. attorneys because a president, particularly of a different party than the previous president, can name these federal prosecutors. Illinois has three judicial districts. We actually have vacancies in almost in all of them. Zachary Farden in Chicago, Jim Lewis in the Central District of Illinois, which he's based in Springfield, was, but he retired in December, so Patrick Hansen is acting U.S. attorney, so that's right for somebody to be named. And in the Southern District of Illinois, there's somebody named Donald Boyce who was named acting and then was appointed by the U.S. court, but the president could replace all three of them. So it's usually the longest-serving member of Congress or, you know, House or Senate in Illinois who oversees recommending to the president who to fill those, of the president's own party, who recommends. John Shimkus, even though he ran on a term limits pledge when he was first elected in 96, still in the House, longest serving Republican member. The Democratic senators from the state, Dick Durbin, Tammy Duckworth, sent him a letter last week saying, we want you to do what everybody's been doing in the state for 20 years, doing a bipartisan screening panel so everybody's okay with the people we nominate to the president, because senators can block nominees from their own state in the Senate Judiciary Committee. So far, John Shimkus's response is, I'm waiting to hear from the Trump administration and Jeff Sessions, the new Attorney General of the country, how they want me to proceed before I figure out exactly what the plan is. So the vacancies are sitting there, and we're waiting to see.
And does the governor have a role in this?
Well, interestingly, the governor, there's somebody named Kathy Lydon who runs his Washington office, who, you know, was invited to be involved in these discussions. The Democratic senator said that's not right. The governor of Illinois should not have that kind of role. Just look at our past governors who got in trouble with prosecutors. Why are we letting, the governor's office be involved? Shimkus's response to that through his spokesman was, John, the congressman, wants to hear from all interested people, the governor included, and we'll listen to pretty much anybody from both sides.
Well, and I would just add that the U.S. attorneys, if in case people have forgotten, refresh their memories that what an important role they've played in the past couple of decades of Illinois government. The U.S. attorney in Chicago was responsible for prosecuting both former Governor George Ryan and then sitting Governor Rod Blagojevich. And it was U.S. Senator Peter Fitzgerald who brought in, no relation, Patrick Fitzgerald to be the U.S. attorney in Chicago. And a lot of people have pointed to that and said that that was sort of a turning point, a change in the way things had been done in the past, and really a lot more independence and less sensitivity to the Illinois political landscape and more sensitivity to federal anti-corruption laws in the way that that job was handled.
Just about a minute or so left here. Brian, if you could recap for us, the Republicans in Congress are pushing forward with a health care proposal, one that would replace Obamacare. And from what we've been hearing in Illinois, it could have some detrimental impacts financially, especially to the state.
Yeah, there was a big hearing on Thursday of this week here in Springfield where House members had officials from the Rauner administration in to talk about that, as well as medical executives from across the state. The basic bottom line is one of the biggest potential financial hits could be with a Medicaid program. $40 billion over the next decade is what it could cost Illinois. There are about 600,000 people who now have access to Medicaid in Illinois because of the expansion under Obamacare. And if Illinois decides to continue that, the state will have to pay for it at a cost of about $3.5 billion a year.
And according to them, the reason for a lot of that, it would cap, I guess, is that what I'd heard, that it would cap the amount of money the state could get?
Yeah, basically. I mean, we should emphasize that seems to be far from a done deal in
sure.
Washington. Things are very fluid there, and it's there are both Democrats and Republicans who have a lot of objections to the repeal and replace legislation that House Speaker Paul Ryan is pushing. But definitely potentially of impacts here in Illinois.
All right, we're going to go to our notes from the field. Charlie, let's start with you.
Well, we spent a lot of time talking about how Speaker Madigan and Governor Rauner are at loggerheads on a lot of stuff, but there's at least one area where they appear to agree, and that is that the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Museum and Library should have its own governing board. Madigan is pushing legislation to accomplish that. It would be an 11-person board appointed by the governor, and the governor in the past has said it's a good idea to split the museum and library off from the Historic Preservation Agency, where the institution is now lodged.
Bernie?
Well, just some things on the 2018 governor's race, which people are already looking for, because who knows if we'll be out of our troubles by then. J.B. Pritzker of Chicago, who has his own Pritzker Enterprises, which is a giant business, and he actually is more wealthy than Governor Rauner, but has about 12,000 employees, I believe, in his businesses, said that he is officially exploring for governor and put about $200,000 in a fund to say that. Meanwhile, Kurt Summers, who is city treasurer of Chicago, also issued a poll that showed Chris Kennedy is in the lead for that. Pritzker was second. He was third. But after people heard these wonderful things about all three, it was Kennedy, then Summers, then Pritzker. It's a long way off. But people are certainly thinking about the next phase.
And Brian.
The Illinois Comptroller at the end of the week saying that the backlog of bills, the amount of money Illinois owes to the various people who have provided services to the state, is $12.8 billion. And they did the math on that. That's about $1,000 for each person who lives in Illinois, according to census figures. $1,000 each for just what Illinois owes now, and that's only getting bigger every day.
Members of our broadcast today included Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and Bernie Schoenberg. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org. You can also find us on NPR One. Look for State Week. The production assistance for the program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.